Hey friends, happy spring to you. This is Vincent from Camp Kaiju, just dropping in, letting you know that we are still in our hiatus period. My little monster kid is 4 months old already, and she is just the light of my life. What more can I say? In terms of the podcast, though, I do want to say that we have a couple more months of some special extra bonus material, some extra special episodes headed your way on the Valley of Gwangi, on Lovecraft in horror movies, and some other things. So stay tuned, including, might I add, one more Frozen with Fear episode. So if you haven't checked out those already, please go back in our episode list and do yourself a favor. So, before we get to Frankenstein Conquers the World with the Frankenstein Minute, guys, just gotta let you know, we saw Godzilla and Kong, the New Empire, last week, and it was a smashing time. Big, dumb kaiju energy headed your way. So, what you're gonna hear first before the main feature is just what I recorded last weekend with the kaiju crew. Our anticipatory initial thoughts, followed by at the end of this episode, our initial reactions, spoiler free, but our first takes on Godzilla and Kong, the New Empire. So look out for a full length episode on that this summer. We're going to start off season 4 properly with Kaijuli. Lots to look forward to this year, lots of new monster movies, lots of classic monster movies to get to. So thanks for enjoying the material we're releasing on a bi-weekly basis. Follow us on campkaijupodcast.com, Letterboxd, and our Instagram. And we can't wait to get going again with the podcast. All right, thanks a lot, guys. Until next time, stay campy. All right, is it 1 o'clock? It's time to roll out. Let's go. Godzilla versus Kong. Camp Kaiju is back. Hiatus over, baby. Here we go. Kaiju crew, we're going to get our initial anticipated reactions. Here we are. Gary Dance to everybody, Jurassic World.
Hello.
Gary, how do you feel about Godzilla versus Kong headed into it?
I'm excited to have a fun, dumb time. Those are my expectations.
Great.
Right now.
Fun and dumb. We got Tall Mike in the leather jacket.
Okay. Yeah. I don't do well with 3D, and I'm hoping I don't throw up.
All right.
I'm not going to sit next to him.
Dan the Man in the brown leather.
Terrible acting, but fun movie.
Can't say it better myself. All right. Hey, Matt Levine, everybody.
Hey, hello. Woo-hoo. What's up? I'm looking forward to it. I haven't seen the last couple. You know, I'm not partial to, like, the newer Godzilla movies. Except for Godzilla Minus One. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. I'm not expecting a lot, but it should be a good time.
Okay.
You should also see Sheen Ultraman. That's the real great kaiju movie from the last couple of years.
There you go. Heard it first. And last and certainly last, Gays do the D, Patrick Kozicki.
The Gay. The Gay is here to tell you I'm excited for Baby Kong. I'm excited for the special effects. And I'm excited for the beer that I'm about to drink as well for the movie. Other than that, here we go.
Ready to go. Cheers, everybody. We'll see you afterwards.
Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum.
And Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts, welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
Yeah, but see, I think the goal is to try to figure out how to work it into the other Frankenstein series. I think I can just about squeak this film into the Universal Frankenstein series, but I don't think I can work around the Hammer series. That one would be tougher.
Yeah, that would be tough.
How would you work this one into the Universal series?
I'll say this. Frankenstein in this movie is in Germany during World War II. And in the Universal series, he's also in Germany. So I don't think you'd have to twist it around too much. This film came out, the scene with the heart, the opening to this film is at the end of World War II. Well, actually, almost the end, which we also see. But at that point, I believe that's between, correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula in the Universal series.
Yep.
There's nothing in the Universal series. Frankenstein's killed at the end of every movie, just about. Mm-hmm. Or maybe, yeah, just about.
Yeah, he is. He is.
So at the end of House of Frankenstein, clearly somebody takes his heart out and and puts it on a U-boat.
Ships it off.
So whatever happens after that, I mean, this film talks about it. It's not complicated. Maybe the rest of his body just stands up and walks. It should be fine.
The only argument I would have with that is that World War II and Nazis are never once referred to in the Universal film series. They don't specifically take place in Germany. It's sort of this mythological sort of European, pastiche. So I think to tie it to World War II, I mean, you could make the argument, sure, but I just don't know that. I mean, if you're doing a hypothetical just for fun, sure.
Well, it's like when Superman met Spider-Man. They don't both live in New York, but they do.
Okay.
One of my favorite things about Frankenstein Conquers the World is that it sort of just seems like fan fiction. Like, it's very good.
Yeah, that's good.
That's the kind of story that a fan fiction writer would write. You know?
That's great.
Yeah.
I actually had this thought that if it had never been made, and if it had never made it to the production stage, and you tried to tell somebody about a lost kaiju film, and you're like, it's Frankenstein, but he's big like a kaiju and he fights Baragon, you'd be like, you're insane.
Get out of here.
I love that Frankenstein setup behind you, Tom. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. This is a mere...
Yeah, that's just a portion of it.
A fraction of the...
fraction of it.
Wow. Very impressive. Cool.
I've got a 12 by 20 foot room that is crammed full of this shit. So that's why I'm broke.
I aspire to a room like that someday.
It took me till now to get it. So
do you have any kaiju to show these guys or anything?
Oh, yeah. It's all in a bin.
We both have plenty of kaiju.
I got plenty of stuff, but it's not out.
Well, yeah, that's my problem, too. It's all down in the basement. One day when I have my dream office, I could put it all out. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought when we bought the house, oh, I'll never fill this. And we've been here a little over a year and I'm overflowing already. So, you know, that's how that goes.
It's a mark of pride, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is, again, why.
I don't know. I mean, clearly I don't have any of my shit up either. So, yeah.
I actually have a CD that I got from Japan that is just all the various roars from all the films.
Wow.
I don't recommend just putting on headphones and kicking back and listening to it. But it is kind of fun to just sort of flip around and listen to the different ones.
Yeah. Well, put it on shuffle. It's better shuffle.
Yeah, just have it playing on Alexa throughout the house.
Make it your alarm clock sound. Yeah.
That'll get you out of bed.
I think it would have. Yeah, that would work. There's no hitting snooze on that one.
Right. Nope.
Just keeps changing up on you.
Mothra's not even in her like moth form in that movie.
Yeah, no.
Wow. You just got larva Mothra, which is fine.
That's the best
still,
Mothra.
That's still pretty
sometimes
cool.
Sometimes that's the best Mothra.
Yeah.
No, I agree. When they gang up on Godzilla in Mothra versus Godzilla, that's like the highlight of the movie.
Yep.
I have to ask, have you seen the modern films with Mothra? She's in Godzilla.
Well, they did. They did. They had that series in the 90s.
Right.
And there was a...
I know she's in...
She's in one of... At least one of those. Then they did three offshoot standalone Mothra movies. In the 90s as
those.
Well. And my kids watched those on endless loops when they were little.
They are perfect for little minds because they're just so outlandishly bonkers.
Colorful and campy kind of.
And for my money, you can't beat GMK.
Oh, no.
Ah, love that movie.
No, not
it's really. Got a certain monster called Baragon in it, but more about that later. See how I did that?
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. I think those are like the only two movies Baragon has been in.
I believe you're right. Yeah.
Which no, he's in Baragon is in Destroy All Monsters.
Oh yeah, very briefly. Right.
For somebody put up a YouTube video of all the Baragon scenes, and the video is 30 seconds long.
I think the reason was,
Baragon a Godzilla canon in the Showa era.
Sure.
Yeah.
The suit was probably in considerable disrepair, which is why it only shows up very briefly.
Right, but that's the thing with Toho. They have so many monsters in their catalog, but they usually give us the same five.
Yeah.
Right. You're always going to get Rodan, Mothra, King Ghidorah, Mechagodzilla. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, some of us may want more Baragon. Some of us may want more. I wish the Gargantuas made more than one movie.
Yep.
Where are they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Titanosaurus, maybe from
let's show Titanosaurus some love. Yeah, it's a really cool looking monster because it looks like it could actually be a real animal, unlike most of the others, which are pretty outlandish.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Baragon
too.
It's aquatic too.
Titanosaurus, right?
Yeah.
Like one of the few that I can think of.
Yep.
That's true.
Ibira.
Mm. All right. One more thing.
Arguably Hedera.
Yeah, arguably.
Or Godzilla, for that matter. Or Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
True, yeah.
It's a little aquatic. They all have to be a bit aquatic just because they had that big tank.
Yeah.
They have to make use of that, yeah.
Damn it, we're going to use it.
They have to make use of it.
Wasn't there an Elvis Godzilla crossover?
Well, there was, you know, if
Blue Hawaii had him in it for a bit, I think.
Abbott and Costello meet Godzilla too. So we talked about the alternate ending that was dictated by, or not dictated, I guess, but the American producer Henry Saperstein, who I think ran UPA. For whatever reason, I think he just loved the octopus in King Kong versus Godzilla and wanted one in here. So if you watch the version that Bill did that has that, it just comes out of nowhere. You know, it's the movie's over. Baragon has been defeated. All of a sudden this octopus comes galumphing along and there's another 5-minute really well staged fight, but it's sort of, one climax too many. It's almost like it's a Peter Jackson movie at that point.
Oh, sure.
I get your point when you say that, but I would say when you say it comes out of nowhere, they actually got the cast back.
Oh yeah, yeah. It doesn't
like
look
one
like
line
it's,
saying, "Oh my God, what's that?" Like they got everybody back.
It doesn't look
to
like it's
that line
horned in awkwardly or anything like that.
Yeah.
It fits, but it just structurally and plot wise just comes out of nowhere.
Like I said, when I first saw it, I didn't know it was coming. I thought it made perfect sense. I'm like, because the movie's kind of like that, right? The movie's weird. And you got this weird kid and he grows up to become a giant. And then there all of a sudden there's this other monster. Like, maybe Frankenstein's not doing all this killing. Maybe it's another monster. And then like to have a third monster at the very end was like, yeah, why not?
Yeah, what the hell?
I bet it was Super Eye's idea. He's like, I got to get my...
well,
I got this... he was just wearing the octopus suit. They're like, you time... should put that in the movie.
Honda didn't know anything about it. Super Eye snuck into the studio with all the actors.
Yeah, there you go.
It said, don't tell
Ishiro. Don't tell him.
We're going to do this.
Like I said, I think I like it because the monsters are much shorter than they would be in a Godzilla film. So... these models were made at like a 1/6 scale, which is, something like that. It's about a foot tall for a person versus a 1/25 scale for a Godzilla, where a person is about 2 inches tall. So I think you get a lot more detail in the set, and it just, the foliage and stuff moves a little bit more naturally than it would in a Godzilla film when they're that much smaller. There are some things that are goofy and look kind of, yeah, you know, the toy tanks bobbling along.
Yeah.
But that's typical of every film in this genre.
Right.
The boar kind of rocking back and forth on its fulcrum.
Yeah.
But again, like I said, Tsuburaya loved that shit. He loved those kind of weird, wonky, almost cartoony effects.
And so do kids, right? Like right. That's like you. I think you may have even said it, Tom. That's what attracts kids to these movies.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like a. It's almost like a wink. Not. I shouldn't say that because these movies do take themselves seriously. But to have an effect like that, that's not dramatic, right?
Yeah.
Like the horse that could have been really frightening.
That could have been, yeah, really.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
And it really isn't.
That's the thing. That's how I feel. But... like it's so far not that it took me out of the action and what was going on.
That can be bad.
Yeah, it can as an adult. Bad. Yeah.
And absolutely. That's why I mention it. Yeah, that one failed in that sense, I feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But overall, I really like the special effects. Matt, were you gonna say something?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that kaiju stuff is good too. It's always fun to see.
It is.
A guy get in there and mix it up. Yeah, I mean, it becomes a very standard thing after a while with Ultraman and the Power Rangers.
Sure,
see that development. Mm-hmm. But is this maybe the first time that a guy just got into that pool?
That's really
very possible. Yeah,
And it works
off the top of my head. Think of anything else? Yeah, I think.
Yeah, what do you guys think?
I did note that scene too. I did notice that, and no, I don't think it is his cells, but maybe it is. I think then who knows? I mean, there's a lot of cells they're looking at in that lab.
Yeah.
But when you talk about just pacing generally, this movie I think does a really good job. This is the kind of pacing I want out of a movie like this. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to just. I don't like Final Wars. I don't really. It's too.
It's just
for me.
Way too much old. Going on.
Yeah.
You kaijus, get off my property. Well, I mean, there's a reason that Ishiro Honda was Akira Kurosawa's go-to guy. You know, not for nothing that he worked with him very closely.
Yeah. Oh, I love his direction. I'm just getting into the Honda, like the beyond just the giant monster stuff. Mm-hmm. I know I have some good movies ahead.
He was a very, very skilled filmmaker.
He always said that one of his favorite, maybe his favorite Godzilla movie that he made was Godzilla's Revenge. So when you do watch that one, I think that's the one to try to remember who's behind it and what messages he's trying to convey. There's a real skill there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's reviled by most of the Godzilla community as the worst Godzilla film. I don't agree at all. I'd have to say Megalon is almost unwatchable at times. but Godzilla's Revenge, or I can't remember its original title off the top of my head.
All Monsters Attack?
Yep.
No.
That's it. No.
Was that? Okay.
Yeah, I think that's it. Okay. It has a very poignant message to it. I mean, you know,
it does.
And it's for a Godzilla movie, it's a deeply personal film.
Right.
Yeah. We'll get there. Someday. It features Matt's favorite kaiju, Mimia.
Gabara?
Oh.
I thought for sure you were going to say Gabara.
Gabara?
I'm being facetious. Matt does not like.
I'm not a fan either.
Yeah.
Of which, Mimia or Gabara or both?
No, Gabara's fine. Gabara, I've got no qualms with. In fact, we're going out for drinks later on. So
for me, Mimia was a little bit.
I must have lost my invite.
No,
to meet Gabara.
No.
Okay. I like that. There's that scientist that was in the war. He's there on the submarine when they hand over the heart. Yeah. He comes up with this theory. Maybe it's a dinosaur that burrows beneath the earth, and he goes to the scientific community, and he meets, I believe. It looks like the guy from King Kong versus Godzilla with the glasses and the mustache. I don't know if it's the same guy, but he says, what do you think of my theory? And the guy says, well, you know, it's not impossible, but I would just have to reject the theory because I think it's highly improbable. The next shot is they're walking out and he goes, they treated me like I was a madman. Like, no, they didn't. I think under the circumstances, they handled you pretty well.
Pretty reasonable, considering.
Pretty reasonable. Once they probably should have called the cops.
And then that yeah. scientist just like leaves the movie at that point, even though he's proven
that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
He's been in everything. He was in the war. He was everywhere.
Like, well, you know, I ran out of money. I got to go.
Yeah.
And then they talk about the money too. Yeah, I think that was like, really well, we can't, we're out of money. This helicopter's expensive.
We can't keep flying that thing around.
I mean, that I could see, I guess where I could see where people think it gets bogged down in that middle section. But when she says it's expensive to hire this helicopter, I'm like, yeah, I bet it would be.
Yeah.
That's a very logical point in an extremely illogical movie. You know?
And they're dropping these huge parcels of food in the middle of nowhere. That's not free either. So
yeah exactly.
You know? Yeah.
I really liked their relationship between him and Koizumi. I like that, just all the details of it, that he shows up and she compliments him on his kimono. And then she puts the flowers in with the other flowers, and then she comes, you know, and you find out it's her birthday.
A lot of that's not in the U.S.
Is none of this?
Oh, well, some of it
sounds really nice, though.
Some of it is,
they spend her birthday. He comes over to her house, and they have dinner, and they tell a terrible joke. So that's what I was going to go into, was this campy joke that they do, and then they do the. Sort of the repeat of that when they're I believe they're at his place, or I don't know where they are, and he's doing the barbecue thing. They do the same kind of joke.
That's equally unfunny.
It's really pretty bad. But it's also like, it's also sort of kind of real. Like,
yeah,
these characters are boring, and that's the kind of humor.
Don't you have little jokes between like you and Jackie that nobody else would find funny? Because I know we do. Yeah. We do. So
absolutely.
Well, no, I was going to mention, you know, I'm trying to think of other, like, even in the 60s, I'm trying to think of other Japanese movies that sort of portray, like, the dropping the atomic bombs, like, explicitly on screen. And it's hard to think of many, even, like, outside of, like, different genre forms. Like, one movie that comes to mind is The Face of Another, which is a really fantastic movie by Hiroshi Teshigahara. But that's definitely, like, a Japanese new wave, like, in-your-face, provocative drama movie. So I almost sort of admire it more for something. I don't want to say admire it more, but I just think it's, for, like, a genre movie like Frankenstein Conquers the World, to include that, take some guts, I think.
It's a ballsy move on their part, I think, yeah.
Yeah. And there are probably others that you know, portray it in similar ways, or just in different ways, or just kind of allude to it or whatever, but... it's hard to think of other ones.
I don't think there's a kaiju film that directly references like this.
Yeah.
And certainly none that actually show it in such a graphic form. It's very striking.
The original
images.
Godzilla references a different event.
Yeah.
Where the US dropped a bomb that near Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's okay. The moment caught me off guard when like I almost forgot. Because there's a title card that says August
6th. Hiroshima, yeah.
And I forgot about that because I was just invested in what's going on with the heart and the doctors.
Yep.
And then the bomb drops, and it caught me by surprise, nevertheless.
And it's a key moment in the film. That's where that's why this all happens.
Yep.
It's good. Yeah, and like when that title card appears, there's just like a huge ball of flame behind it, right? Like it could not be any like more overt, like, you know, the explosiveness literally of this historical event.
I wonder if it reflects a growing up of some kind in the 60s in the US that it was probably generally accepted that's probably not okay to drop a nuclear bomb on your enemy.
You think maybe?
I mean, I don't know. It sounds obvious now, but maybe it didn't feel that way so much in the 50s. I don't know.
No, I don't think it did in the 50s.
Had our own scares then, the nuclear scares.
Yeah. Certainly not in the US, it didn't. And I don't think we had that collective guilt about it until the late 60s, when we get into the Vietnam era and things like that. But even in school in the 70s and early 80s, for me, we did the right thing. We ended that war. We did the right thing by dropping those bombs. There was no other alternative. And even, you know, then I thought that was bullshit, but Sorry. But
that's one case where that's totally accurate to say.
Okay. All right.
Can't, all right. There's no better phrase.
It's like being told that Columbus discovered America. And I asked my elementary school teacher that, well, didn't the people that were here first discover it before him? And yeah, that was brushed aside pretty quickly.
Close your books. Now we're going to talk about Hiroshima. Tom, put your hand down.
Frankenstein Conquers the World is not a primary source document.
But, you know, for people that haven't seen it, like most of us on this call hadn't seen it, it's pretty amazing because you don't see that in any other kaiju films from that.
No, era. It really is very striking.
But like you were saying, to me, as a, you know, whenever you think about World War II, it sort of ends really fast, right? Like mm-hmm. Russia gets to Berlin, mm-hmm. and then America drops the bomb. But that period in between, to think that Germany would take this heart and bring it to Japan implies this really strong bond between Japan and Germany that I don't know if it ever really
existed. I don't know that ever really was, yeah.
Do you guys know I'm a social studies teacher?
No.
Well, we do now.
I knew that.
Well, I mean, I was going to say for us to, I almost, it's funny because if you hadn't said that, the next thing I was going to say was far be it for me to tell the Japanese how to make the movie about their own history. But apparently we decided to go there.
You brought up a good point. And I took last spring, I took a whole semester long course on World War II, and all this was new to me and part of my licensure and yada yada. The alliance between Germany and Japan was not as deep as you may think. Like, yes, they on paper, absolutely, but there wasn't as much of that collaboration as you would think.
Okay.
Well, and that's why I think it was surprising to watch this movie where the Germans are like, well, we're done for, guys. But maybe you can make maybe something can out make of it. Some, yeah. It's, I mean, right? That's the only way to interpret it.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
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 Yeah. All righty. Well, I guess that's it.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, that's it?
Oh, all right.
Oh, we're not going to talk about the... No, I'm kidding.
I will say
about the horse some more?
I do definitely want to see the subtitled version with the giant octopus, so I will find a way to see that version for sure.
I think you will.
Cool.
Wink, either, wink.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, either I wasn't trying to imply that too much, but
yeah,
either,
no. I'll take care of you.
Thank you. But if not from you guys, then I definitely want to track it down somehow. So
yeah.
But thank you.
I think I actually think the octopus scene by itself is on YouTube somewhere as well.
Ooh. Okay.
But apparently most of them are, because every time I said anything, you guys are like, "What? That wasn't in the movie."
And honestly, you mentioned some things that I thought sounded really good, like worth watching.
Yeah, certainly the Japanese version is worth taking the trip.
Might be worth doing a breakdown to figure out where they're different. And we did that on our podcast. Obviously, we do minute by minute. So there we found out that the version of Son of Frankenstein that's on the Blu-ray, we're currently doing Son of Frankenstein, it's like 3 minutes or 2 minutes. No, it's like a minute and a half.
It's not
maybe.
Even, yeah, it's barely
yeah.
2 minutes.
Longer than the DVD version. So I found that out. And if you're going minute by minute, it's like, well, I better figure out every two seconds. That's
every moment that's, yeah.
And I think this movie, after having this conversation, might be, well, not worth going minute by minute, but just trying to analyze what's different.
I'll tell you what you should not do is go to the IMDb and look up alternate versions, because a lot of that information is wrong, as is the case often on the IMDb.
You mean like I found out in, I don't know, 1970 something, that the Japanese version of King Kong versus Godzilla, Godzilla wins, and in the American version, King Kong wins. I think that's still on IMDb.
That's still on there, yeah. That goes back to, again, Famous Monsters of Filmland,
right.
I think, is where that first appeared.
Yeah, before the internet, when there was mystery to these things, like with foreign films, and it's like you just heard rumors.
Yep.
Yeah. I miss those days. I remember those days ever so slightly.
Yeah, I do kind of miss the thrill of the hunt You know, yeah, everything yeah. now is so easily accessible. Even yeah. if it's not commercially available, you're going to find it somewhere.
Right.
You know, for decades, I wanted to see a film called The Old Dark House. It was the film that Karloff and James Whale made immediately after Frankenstein, and it just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And somehow or another, this was in the 80s, I tracked down a bootleg VHS copy. It took forever to find it, and it looked, you know, like it was 8mm print projected on a bed sheet in broad daylight, but I at least got to see the film.
Yeah, I get that.
The thing about yeah. that one is you're waiting and waiting and you're hoping it's going to be good, and yeah. oh no, it's not good. It's one of the greatest.
It's one of the best movies. Films of ever. Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that movie's incredible. Also, I remember when I was a kid, Bravo, when they used to show like actual movies instead oh, yeah. of just like reality TV all the
time. Instead of crap, yeah.
Yeah, they were showing 8½ by Fellini, which oh. I had never seen before. Okay. And we were supposed to visit my grandparents, and I like forced my parents to like delay that by a day so I could watch 8½ on Bravo. One of my beautiful. Proudest moments from when I was a kid.
Yeah, no kidding. That worked out well.
Man
yeah.
after my own heart.
Yeah, that's a and great
now,
one.
You know, of course, now you can see 8½ wherever you want, basically.
Right. Like, yeah, I suppose.
So. Definitely on YouTube. Yep, exactly. Definitely on the Criterion channel, because I was maybe sure. going to watch it later tonight, as a matter of fact.
Oh, nice. Yep. That's a nice segue, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. You sealed my fate, because now I'm going to have to.
Well, yeah, this was great.
Yeah,
yeah. Hopefully we'll see what happens, but future conversations or collaborations would be great. But this was a lot of fun.
Sure. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. Thanks for having us. It was yeah. a lot of fun.
You have to commend it on so many other aspects than just, oh, it's a well-written story or it was well acted. It was. You know, there are other strengths that we can focus on.
Yeah, and I think it's the kind of movie where like objective criteria of goodness and artfulness and all that like almost is irrelevant. Like I feel like that's not even what the movie's trying to do, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later.
And even today, for what it's worth, we're not fans of Rotten Tomatoes on Camp Kaiju, but it does hold a 92%, which I don't agree with.
I think it's funny to imagine somebody who only goes by Rotten Tomatoes ratings, like that's the way they decide what movies to see, and that convinces them to watch this movie, and they're just like completely outraged by it. I hope that's happened at least once to some viewer out there who loves Rotten Tomatoes.
But I wanted to include it just because by some measure of standard, it is standard of measure. It is, you know, indicative of the polarizing reputation of the film. Maybe you either love it or you hate it. I don't love it, but a lot of people do.
Yeah, you're right that a lot of people love it, and we probably I love it and hate it, but like the people who love it, you know, just kind of making claims about how like brilliant and subversive it is and all the sort of political themes that it tackles. And like I definitely, even though I'm pretty sure I like this movie more than you, I guess we'll probably find out in a little bit here, Vincent, but yeah, I would not go that far, though. Like, it's definitely not a masterpiece, and I think, like, some of the good things about it are, like, unintentional, you know? So I am kind of surprised to, like, read some of the glowing reviews that are, like, this is a subversive masterpiece or whatever. It's like, let's slow down a little bit there, but yeah, it is very polarizing, for sure.
Joe D'Alessandro, when he's used in movies where he, like, doesn't speak, because he is, like an extremely handsome man, and obviously is, like, a striking...
Several of the movies that he made with Paul Morrissey, he plays a male prostitute in New York. So, like, you could probably buy him as a male prostitute in New York. That seems like the
hello
role
everybody.
Kind of born to play. But
thank
like,
you for listening to this, Flesh for Frankenstein. Yeah, give it up for so Frank Olson, convincing. A wonderful guest, time and time again, helping us break down Flesh for Frankenstein. Of course, we have some bonus content to share with you after these brief messages. Of course, I'm going to say that you should check out patreon.com/campkaiju. Check out our tiers, see the various benefits available to you from $3 a month all the way to $15 a month. I also wanted to just without further ado, please enjoy the without further ado, please enjoy this cut for time content and stay tuned for our next episode next week. Matt and I will be breaking down The Valley of Guanji from 19... And stay tuned for our next episode. Next week, we are going to the American West with some dinosaurs in the Valley of Guanji from 1969, directed by Jim O'Connelly and special effects by the one and only Ray Harryhausen. So rent that, buy that, watch that if you can, and get ready to discuss a pretty thrilling cult classic. All right, catch you later. All right, till then. Stay campy. Right. And speaking of camp and queerness at this time surrounding Flesh for Frankenstein, you know, part of the counterculture is the rise of LGBTQ plus rights and civil rights and activism, especially following the Stonewall riots in 1969. I think that's right. In Greenwich Village in New York City. All of this is the same cultural cauldron in which Andy Warhol, his superstars, the Factory, are living within. So everything is just feeding off of each other. And you can see that, I think, in Flesh for Frankenstein. The relationship between Sasha and Nicholas, especially, you know, they're in the bordello and they one of them is interested in the women and one of them is not. And then extending that when the creatures in the male and female are alive, when they're brought to life and they have zero sexual chemistry between them, especially Sasha. He is very uninterested, I would say, in the female, which actually is a nice inverse of the Bride for Frankenstein classic climax there, when the bride is very much disinterested in the monster himself. So all this to say, any conversation about Flesh for Frankenstein cannot exist without discussing the broader cultural implications of the queer community and gay activism in the early 1970s. I am by no means an expert, and I would just encourage you all to go forth, read up on this history, on cinema history, read up on this history, both in cinema and the American culture in general. Really, really rewarding stuff there. What else we got? Right, not convincing. I didn't find the dialogue convincing. You know, if you're going to improvise or if you're going to write scenes the day of, just don't do that just because it's going to come off really bad. And then you have bad actors performing bad dialogue. I'm like, this is borderline unbearable for me right now.
Yeah, and there are examples of like directors who have done that, like Jean-Luc Godard did that a lot. Wong Kar-wai did that a lot, but
yeah,
they had good actors and like they had like points of view in their movies and, you know, thought that was put into them. So right. So even if they're doing some of these kind of off the cuff things, they were doing it in the context of like a, you know, overall framework that they had thought out.
It is a feat that takes a special caliber of I'm overusing the word talent, but but that's what I mean. Yeah.
Chelsea Girls might be one of the most famous films that he directed. I think he co-directed that one with Warhol, however. From 1966. I've never seen that. I think it's like more than 3 hours, and it's a lot of monologues that are kind of presented in split screen. So that seems maybe a little bit closer to like the Empire end of things, of like being very avant-garde and experimental, and maybe not so much like Flesh for Frankenstein.
I just think it's as far as the fascism thing goes, I think it's just so weird that they kind of go halfway with it by, you know, making him so insistent on it being a Serbian race specifically, even though, you know, it's clearly a German actor. He's got the, you know, kind of like stereotypical Nazi accent and everything. I just thought that was a really weird aspect of the movie, and I don't know why they would have made that decision.
Yeah, part of me wonders if it isn't like trying to be a very dark joke that, like, in, you know, instead of like the master German race, it's like, you know, probably something you wouldn't really expect from the Serbians, who have never like committed atrocities at the level that, you know, like Germany did during World War II. So the only reason I can think of to make that change is to like have a sort of absurd joke about that, which whether or not it's funny or successful, I guess, is up to each individual viewer. But yeah. And I also, you know, like, you know, Midnight Cowboy, I think, is another example. And I think, Vincent, you brought that up before. That's a movie that I like a lot, but I think it looks, you know, very sleazy, and that's maybe probably what it's going for. But like, yeah, like the days of like, you know, New York City in all of its glory, definitely that did not happen in the 70s, at least in Midnight Cowboy. I guess the movie's from 69, but.
But that mirrors the real life decline of New York City. Times Square in the 70s was not a place you wanted to go, but in the 60s and 50s it was the spot. It was, you know, bright and safe and clean.
Right. Yeah, it does seem fitting for like the sleazy, trashy vibes of these movies.
The sound effect, did you get that in your what you watched?
Yeah
It's this like sucking sound effect that went on so long.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And you can see what she's doing sort of briefly, like some of it is cut off, but then you can see her just like, yeah, just sucking on his armpit. And it's like very, very ridiculous. Like moments like that, it's like, all right, this movie has to kind of know how like ridiculous and over the top it is, right?
I almost had the impression that like maybe that was written as like an oral sex thing or something, and then maybe like the actors didn't feel comfortable doing it or whatever, and then they modified it to that. But it does come off very bizarre. Either that, or it's like a like very specific fetish that Paul Morrissey has or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that was my impression too, actually. That this was just like a stand-in for oral sex. But she is sucking his armpit, so I don't know.
Yeah.
It just seems so strange to me that for a movie with so much like, you know, tasteless, disgusting, provocative stuff, like that's where they draw the line, you know? I know actually like performing oral sex on screen is like a big, you know, a lot of actors probably would not want to do that. But it just seems kind of funny to me that like that's the point at which the movie is like, no, this is going too far. We have to use armpits instead. But yeah, like we don't really, you know, it's hard to know exactly like what the motivation for that scene is like so much in this movie, which yeah, it's very amusing, really over the top, really ridiculous. So there's some great stuff. We just finished our Frozen with Fear Patreon series, a couple, is it Coast Guard members stationed in Antarctica, is that right, Vincent?
Yeah, so my brother Max and his buddy are recording reviews of monster movies set in Antarctica. There are actually two more episodes left in this now four-part series, available only to patrons. So the next movie hopefully dropping this weekend is John Carpenter's The Thing. They're going to review that film, as well as a movie they threw in unbeknownst to me. Maybe you guys have heard of this movie, Cold Skin.
I have not heard of that.
Oh. Is that a zombie movie?
Yes. It's from 2017, directed by Xavier Jens. And I think it involves zombies in the Arctic or something like that. So
I think I might have actually seen that, but it sounds vaguely familiar. If I have seen it, it did not stick with me, but it does sound vaguely familiar.
Well, my brother seems to love it. So I love people who love, I love people's love for things. So I am looking forward to his discussion about it. Hey, just got out of Godzilla and Kong. Here are our first reactions post movie.
Hey, it's pretty good. It's a lot of fun. Special effects are good. There's a lot of cliche and some kind of dumb comic relief, but it's very entertaining. Should I just pass this down the line?
Pass it on down the line.
Amazing. Cool. Oh, hello. Yeah, you know what? It was super cute. Diddy Kong did not let me down, so I loved it.
I did not throw up. And we learned what happened when King Kong has a toothache and when Godzilla's sleepy. Don't wake him up.
I had a pretty fun time with this. You know, I think it's a little unnecessarily stupid at times. It doesn't have to be like that stupid at certain parts, but I think this franchise knows what it is, and it is, it's fun, visually fun, and yeah.
Is it fun though? It was fun.
King Kong or Daddy Kong? I now have a weird King Kong fetish. Oh. Sorry, Patrick.
Yeah. I mean, sorry to disappoint you.
Yeah, you're not wrong there. All right. Camp Kaiju out.